The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening, dear listeners. Welcome again to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and I've been wandering the darker corridors of this world longer than most of you have been alive. Plenty of time to stumble into more than a few places I probably shouldn't have, and to survive just long enough to tell you about them.
And I'm Malcolm Blackwood, joining you again from somewhere between the flicker of the candlelight and the place your mind tells you not to look. Tonight's episode, Beneath and Beyond, will have us lingering in thresholds best left unmarked, under the covers, in abandoned rooms, beneath still waters, and beyond the point where the living should tread.
We've gathered five tales for you this evening, each pulling you deeper into the hidden corners of the world, where danger lives just out of sight until you step too close. From the subtle horrors of your own bedroom to a retreat where team building takes on a bloodier meaning, we'll be exploring what lurks underfoot, overhead, and everywhere in between.
So settle in, keep your feet tucked in tight, your doors bolted, and your wits about you. The dark is patient, but tonight, it won't have to wait long.
And remember, when you gaze into the abyss, it doesn't just gaze back. Sometimes, it smiles. Before we begin, a quick word about how you can hear even more of the nightmares we have in store.
By becoming a patron at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com or SimplyScaryPodcast.com, you can unlock the patrons area for just $7.99 a month, or less with a yearly plan.
You'll get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes, early releases, and extended editions with extra stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It's also the single best way to support what we do here, keeping independent horror alive and thriving.
So if you enjoy the show, head over to our site, click the patrons link, and sign up today. We'll keep the nightmares coming, if you're brave enough to ask for more. Our first tale this evening serves as a reminder that even the safest places aren't always as secure as you think. Some dangers don't look in the woods or on lonely streets, but right at the edge of your bed. This is Never Sleep With Your Feet Sticking Out by Margot Klein, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. I know everyone has their quirks when it comes to sleep. Some people need white noise, some need total silence. Some sleep with one leg out because they like the cold air on their skin. Others can only fall asleep in their stomachs or after checking every door in the house. Me? I tuck the blanket under my feet every single night. Like under. tight as hell so that nothing can get in. I don't care if it's summer and I'm sweating through my sheets. I don't let my feet stick out. Ever. People laugh when I tell them that. Or they say, oh, that's cute. Left every kid thing. My ex used to tease me for it. She thought it was a comfort thing, like a sensory quirk, or maybe something to do with anxiety. But it's not about comfort. It's about protection. I've done this every single night since I was 17, and I'm not writing this for sympathy or attention or to start a debate. I'm writing this because something's happening again, and I think, no, I know it's connected to what happened back then. Before I get into it, I just want to say that I've never told this story to anyone. Not to my parents, not to my therapist, not even to Chelsea. And we were together for 4 years. I tried once when we were camping. I got about halfway through and felt my skin crawling. I couldn't finish. She thought I was joking. But this past weekend, my nephew woke up screaming in the middle of the night. He'd been sleeping over in the guest room. I rushed in and he was curled up in a corner, sobbing, saying something had touched his foot. It felt like someone had poured ice water down my back. That's why I'm here telling this instead of trying to sleep. Why the blanket's tucked around my ankles so tightly that it's cutting off my circulation. I'm not looking for answers or trying to be dramatic. I just need someone else to hear it. So yeah, this all started when I was 17, during the summer after my junior year. My parents had taken a week off to go on one of those couples hiking retreats in Colorado, and they left me home alone for the first time ever. I had a part-time job back then at a used bookstore. Weekday mornings, nothing fancy, and I promised I'd keep up with my shifts and not burn the house down. Fair trade for a whole week of independence. At first, it was awesome. I stayed up late watching horror movies on VHS. I was going through a vintage phase. Ate like garbage and stretched out in their big bed like a king. I invited a couple of friends over to hang out most nights. Nothing wild, just movies, video games, and stupid jokes. You know how that age feels? Like you're on the edge of the world, just dipping your toe into adult freedom. One night, I think it was a Thursday, I had Ty and Chelsea over for pizza and a movie. We ended up watching The Ring, which, yeah, I know, sounds tame now, but Ty hated creepy kids in horror movies. He was jumping at shadows all night, pretending not to be scared, while checking behind the couch every few minutes. At some point during the movie, Chelsea curled her feet up on the couch and said something like, "Y'all ever been getting that feeling that somebody's going to grab your foot if it's hanging off the bed?" Ty laughed. Yeah, when I was like 8. Okay, but why is that a universal fear, she asked. What is that? Evolution? Parents traumatizing us with too many bedtime stories? I chimed in. Nah, it's because of that dumb story from elementary school. Remember? About the kid who got dragged under the bed because his foot was hanging off? Oh my God, yes! Chelsea snapped her fingers. The one where they found scratch marks on the floor. Urban legends, man, Ty said, shaking his head. So dumb. And then Chelsea, with that mischievous grin she always had, turned to me and said, I dare you to sleep with your foot hanging off tonight. Just one. Let it dangle, like bait. Wow, I said, laughing. What are we, in second grade again? Come on, Ty said, egging me on. Prove you're not scared of bedtime goblins. It was stupid. I knew it was stupid. But I also knew I couldn't back down. I wasn't about to be the guy who chickened out of a silly dare. So when they crashed on the living room floor and I went upstairs to bed, I did it. I lay on my side, got comfortable, pulled the blanket up to my chest, and let one foot stick out, just barely. My heel hung maybe 4 inches past the edge. I remember lying there in the dark, feeling a little foolish, but also somewhat nervous. I think the idea had wormed its way into my head more than I wanted to admit. But nothing happened, at least not at first. I drifted off, listening to Ty snoring downstairs, And the last thing I remember thinking was how ridiculous it was all. That was the last night I ever let my feet hang off the bed. It was the cold that woke me. It was concentrated, focused, as if someone were holding an ice cube against the ball of my foot. For a second, I thought I'd kick the covers off in my sleep, but then I remembered I meant to leave it out. My leg was stretched across the bed, and my heel was still hanging just past the edge. The rest of me was swaddled like usual, but that one exposed foot, it felt like it was in a meat locker. I blinked into the dark, still groggy. The house was silent. There was no Ty snoring, no Chelsea whispering through the vents to freak me out. Everything was eerily still. I shifted my leg to pull it back up under the blanket. The muscles responded, but slowly, like I was underwater or drugged. The blanket bunched, but I couldn't quite get the momentum. My heel still dangled. And then something touched me. It wasn't my imagination. It was fingers wrapping around the back of my ankle, soft and clammy like half-thawed rubber. I froze, every muscle locking up. My mind sprinted through possibilities. Ty snuck upstairs? Chelsea? No, no one else was in the room. My door had been closed. I would have heard them come in, right? I started to sit up, to scream, but my voice caught my throat and nothing came out. My chest fell like it was caving in. All I could do was blink and sweat and feel those fingers around my ankle tightening up. And then I heard breathing, wet and slow, coming from directly beneath me, followed by a whisper. "I see you, Danny." My name, in a voice that didn't sound male or female or even human. And it was closed, like it was pressed right up against the floorboards. I remember jerking my leg upward so violently that my hip cracked. My heel hit the frame. I scrambled backward until I was balled up against the headboard, panting and covered in sweat. The hand, or whatever it was gone. The whispering stopped, and everything was quiet again. I couldn't even bring myself to look under the bed. I just curled my legs up and yanked the blanket around them so tightly that it nearly cut off my blood flow. I didn't sleep, not for the rest of that night. At dawn, I crept downstairs. Ty and Chelsea were still asleep in their makeshift blanket pile, blissfully unaware. I stood there in the hallway for a good 5 minutes trying to convince myself I'd imagined it, that it was a dream, sleep paralysis, whatever. But I didn't feel paralyzed. I had moved, kicked, and run. And I still remember the exact pressure of those fingers molding themselves around me. Later, when we were eating leftover pizza for breakfast, I asked if either one of them had come upstairs during the night. They looked confused. "No," Chelsea said. "Why?" "No reason," I mumbled. Ty belched and said, "You sure, bro?" "Yeah," I muttered. "Don't worry about it." I didn't tell them. Not then. Not ever, actually. What would I have said? "Hey, guys, remember that stupid dare? Well, something grabbed my foot, whispered my name on cue, and now I'm scared to walk past my own bed." They would have either laughed it off or looked at me like I needed therapy. But that was the moment something shifted. I don't know how else to describe it. From that point on, I felt watched, like I'd made a terrible mistake or broken some kind of unspoken rule. From that night on, the blanket stayed tucked around my ankles. I didn't care what anyone said or how hot it got. I didn't even care if it made me look like an idiot, because I knew something had touched me, something real, and it knew my name. After that night, I couldn't stand the idea of uncovered feet, not even for a second. It wasn't just when I was in bed. I started sitting on the couch with my legs pulled up, tucking the blanket under my heels, even when it was 90 degrees outside. I'd wake up drenched in sweat, the sheets plastered to me, but I wouldn't loosen them. The fear wasn't a joke anymore. It bled into my mornings, too. At the bookstore, my co-workers noticed how wrecked I looked. I'd show up late, hair unbrushed, and nurse bad coffee all day long just to keep my eyes open. One slow Tuesday, I was restocking the front display when Danny, one of the weekend clerks, wandered over. "You look like hell," she said flatly. "Thanks," I muttered. No, seriously, you sick or something?" I hesitated. Part of me wanted to blow it off, but something about her tone felt less like teasing and more like she was actually concerned. "I couldn't sleep," I said. "I had this freaky thing happen the other night." She raised an eyebrow. "Well, what kind of freaky?" I don't know why, but I was honest, mostly. I told her I'd been dared to sleep with my foot dangling off the bed, and later woke up and thought I felt something grab it. I left out the details about the whisper and the breathing. Danny chuckled, but didn't entirely look like she thought I was joking. "My little cousin used to have a thing about that," she said. "Wouldn't let his toes stick out under the covers. He'd cry if someone pulled a blanket up off of him." "Why?" I asked. She shrugged. "Said something was under there. My aunt just thought it was weird." She wandered off to help a customer, leaving me standing there holding a stack of paperbacks. That night, I brought it up to my aunt when she called to check in on the house. I don't know why. I think I was testing the waters. "You ever hear of anyone not letting their feet dangle off of the bed?" I asked. There was a pause. "That's a strange question," she said slowly. "Why?" "No reason, just something a friend mentioned." "Well," she said after a moment, "your grandfather always used to tuck the blankets under his feet. Said it was to keep the cold out, but..." Her voice trailed off. "But what?" I asked. "Oh, nothing. It's silly. It's just he claimed something scratched him under the bed when he was a boy. Probably mice or bats. You know how those old farmhouses were." She changed the subject right after that and started talking about my uncle's garden. I didn't press the issue any further, but the rest of the night, I kept replaying what she'd said. "Scratched him under the bed." She hadn't sounded like she thought it was funny. By the end of the week, I had told two more people, Chelsea in passing and my mom, when she called to check in. Chelsea laughed it off, but Mom's reaction was off. She went quiet for a long moment and then said, "That's interesting," before asking if I had eaten breakfast yet. The lack of a straight reaction made it worse. It was like they all knew something, or at least had heard something like it before, but none of them wanted to talk about it. And maybe they didn't have anything to say, but it felt like the more I brought it up, the more obvious it was that this wasn't the first time something like this had happened and that I wasn't alone. I just had no idea what that meant for me. It happened again, but a week later. I wasn't even in bed that time. I'd crashed on the couch after a long shift. I'd been halfway through a rerun of some crime show when I drifted off. I didn't have a blanket, it was just me, sprawled on my back, one leg, kicked out over toward the end of the cushion. When I woke, the room was pitch black and the TV had gone into sleep mode. My head felt fuzzy, like I'd been out for hours, but my mind was instantly alert, because my foot was bare and it was freezing. Felt like the same cold as before, localized, unnatural, seeping into the bone. I told myself to pull it back, tuck it under me, but before I could move, I heard it. A voice. It was faint, like someone whispering from behind the couch. "You left the door open." It wasn't loud, but the words sank straight into me. I froze, every nerve screaming, feeling like I might pass out. The door in our living room led to the basement, and I knew for a fact it had been closed when I sat down. Now, it was flung wide open. Then the grip returned. The same fingers and the same clammy, rubbery texture clamped just above my ankle, tighter than before. And then they pulled. I yelped and kicked instinctively, the movement jerking my whole body sideways. My heel slammed into the couch frame, pain shooting up my leg. But I kept thrashing until I landed hard on the floor. The pulse stopped and everything went quiet. I stayed there for a long time, knees to my chest, staring at the couch. Nothing moved. Eventually, I lunged for the wall switch. The room flooded with light, but there was nothing there. No one behind the couch, no footprints on the carpet. Nothing but me, shaking so badly I could barely breathe. When I rolled up my pajama pants, I saw faint bruises, wrapping almost completely around my leg like an uneven ring. The kind of marks you'd get if someone had gripped you with both hands and squeezed. I told my mom about it the next day when she got home. I tried to keep it light, make it sound weird but not insane. She listened, arms crossed, not interrupting. When I finished, she just stood there for a while. Finally, she said, "When you were a baby, you used to scream if your feet weren't covered. I mean, every single night. You'd thrash until we tucked them in. We thought you were just fussy." I waited for her to laugh to tell me how ridiculous it was, but she didn't. Instead, she looked uneasy. "I'm sure it's nothing," she added quickly, like she'd realized she'd said too much. "Just a habit you had when you were little." It didn't sound like she believed what she was saying, and as much as I wanted to, I'm afraid I didn't either. At work that weekend, I was clumsy from exhaustion, dropping books and forgetting where I'd put the scanner. Danny noticed again. I brushed her off, but later, when she was clocking out, she said, "You look like you were running from something, you know?" I opened my mouth to deny it, but stopped. She was right. I was. I built my whole adult life around this. I don't own a bed frame anymore. My mattress sits directly on the floor. I sleep in socks, sometimes two pairs, with the blanket tucked under me so tightly it might as well be stitched on. Even on the hottest nights of the year, I won't risk it. I've woken up drenched and lightheaded from heat before, but never once with my feet exposed. People think it's quirky. I don't argue. I don't bother explaining anymore. For years, nothing happened. I didn't experience the cold grip, hear the whispers, or see any bruises. Eventually, I started to think it had given up, whatever it was, or maybe that I'd just outrun it. I still kept my feet tuckered, just in case, but the edge of panic dulled over time. Then, last weekend, my sister asked if her son could spend the night. My nephew Marcus is 8, a bundle of energy who talks about dinosaurs like they're still roaming the earth. I was happy to have him over. I set him up in my guest room. What I didn't do, and I don't know why, was warn him. It didn't even cross my mind until I heard him screaming. It was past midnight when it happened. He shouted, sharp and panicked, the kind of sound that launches you out of bed before your brain catches up. I bolted down the hall, heart pounding, and found him in the corner of the room, pressed up against the wall, his blanket bunched with his fists. His eyes were wide and glassy, and he was staring straight ahead at nothing. "What happened?" I asked, crouching down. He shook his head at first, then whispered, "Something touched my foot." I swear the air left the room. He refused to get back into bed, and I ended up letting him sleep in my room, beneath my fortress of tucked blankets, where he finally dozed off sometime before dawn. I didn't sleep at all. The next morning, I asked him again what had happened. He barely remembered, saying he might have dreamt it, but I could tell by the way he avoided looking at the bed that it hadn't felt like a dream to him. I tried to tell my sister. She rolled her eyes, said kids have nightmares all the time, and brushed it off. But later that night, I heard her on the phone with someone, her voice low and filled with worry. When she noticed me, she ended the call fast. The night after Marcus went home, I heard scratching again. This time it wasn't coming from under my bed, it was coming from the closet. I stood in the dark, listening, every muscle tensed. The scratching went on for maybe 30 seconds, then stopped. Whatever was stalking me was getting bolder, changing tactics. I kept thinking about what my mom had said. You've had this since you were a baby. Which means this thing, whatever it is, never left. It was just waiting for the right moment. Fortunately, I haven't heard or felt anything since the closet incident, but I can't help but feel that the moment I drop my guard, something awful is going to happen. So yeah, sleep however you want, but me? I'll never let my feet stick out again, not even for a second. I won't give it the satisfaction. That was Never Sleep With Your Feet Sticking Out by Margot Klein, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. And here I thought the worst thing about dangling my feet was stepping on a cold floor. Seems I underestimated the things lying in wait.
All the more reason to keep the blankets tucked in tight. You never know who or what is looking for an easy way in.
If that first story has you craving more terror before you turn in for the night, well, you'll be pleased to know there's a brand new way to keep the chills coming.
Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, 30 Tales of Terror, our first ever print anthology, is now available on Amazon. This first volume collects 30 unforgettable tales from some of the darkest minds in modern horror, each accompanied by a haunting illustration by artist David Romero.
You'll find everything from strange cats and body mutilations to demonic apartments, revenge from beyond the grave, and yes, even a man-eating monster or two.
And for those who prefer their scares in audio form, there's a newly released audiobook edition featuring Eric Peabody, the host and narrator of the Horror Hill podcast.
So turn off the lights, turn on the dark, and get your copy of Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, 30 Tales of Terror today. Who needs sleep anyway?
Our next story leads us into a home where companionship comes at a steep cost. Here, a seemingly ordinary cat is far from harmless, feeding not on kibble, but on something far more vital. I present to you Solace by Laurel Veitch, performed by yours truly, Malcolm Blackwood. The calendar on her fridge still showed May, though the heat pressing through Marla's windows said otherwise. Her air conditioner had wheezed its final breath sometime in April, and the repairman she had called never showed up. She stopped following up after the second voicemail. It didn't seem worth the effort. Most days, she stayed inside her small cottage on the edge of town, curtains half drawn, windows streaked with pollen and dust. The floor tiles curled slightly at the corners, and the ceiling fan creaked when it turned. Everything in the house felt tired, but Marla didn't mind. Her job, copy editing for a handful of self-published romance authors, required little of her. The hours were erratic, the pay inconsistent, but it suited her. She hadn't had to speak to anyone in person for weeks. Occasionally, her sister called, always during dinner, always with that half-cheerful, half-pleading tone that made Marla feel both loved and accused. She'd answer, sometimes. Outside, the neighborhood had grown quieter than usual. Lawnmowers no longer buzzed on Sunday afternoons. No children shouted from backyards or rode bikes down the crumbling sidewalk. Cars passed less frequently, and when they did, they moved slowly, their windows rolled up, their faces blank behind the glare of their windshields. The town, it seemed, was becoming increasingly withdrawn. The only thing growing was the heat, warping the wood and souring the air. In the evenings, the cicadas started early and ended late, their endless trill filling the silence. Marla didn't mind the stillness. She had learned long ago that life was quieter after certain losses. She kept her habits small and her world smaller. Coffee at 7, emails at 9, a short walk to the mailbox by noon, if she remembered. It was on one such walk, barefoot, slow-moving, the sky already growing hazy with heat, that she first noticed the cat. It sat at the end of her walkway, perfectly still, staring at her. A large gray shape, its eyes the color of old coins. The cat didn't run when Marla stepped closer. She paused a few feet from it, feeling the heat rising off the pavement through the soles of her feet. The cat's fur looked oddly plush for summer, its coat thick and unruffled. It didn't blink. Its eyes remained fixed on her face. "Are you lost?" she asked. It didn't respond. Of course it didn't. Still, something about the silence between them felt conversational. She crouched, wincing as her knees popped, and extended a hand. The cat leaned forward slowly and pressed the top of its head against her fingers. Its fur was warm, almost hot, and startlingly smooth. "Well," she muttered, "I guess you're mine now." She opened the door behind her. The cat walked past her legs and into the house without a sound. She didn't think to check for a collar. It didn't take to food. She offered tuna, then dry kibble she'd had in the pantry from a stray that passed through last fall. The cat didn't sniff it and didn't approach the bowl. Instead, it circled the living room once, stopped beside the foot of the couch, and stared at her until she sat down. "Is this what you want?" she asked softly, easing herself onto the cushion. He jumped up beside her without hesitation, turned a slow half-circle, then climbed into her lap. He was heavier than she'd expected. She didn't move for nearly an hour. That night, he followed her into the bedroom. She left the door cracked, out of habit, and when she rolled onto her side beneath the fan, she saw his silhouette by the doorframe. She patted the blanket once, and the cat sauntered over. He stepped onto the bed in total silence, padded toward her chest, and lay down squarely over her ribs, aligning his paws over her heart, with his head resting just beneath her chin. He never made a sound, purr or twitch. He just stayed there, watching her, as Marla felt the weight of him sink through the blanket. That was the first night she slept without dreaming. The next morning, she named him Solace. It came out of her mouth unbidden, as if she'd always known it. He didn't react to the name, but even so, he followed her from room to room that day, never straying more than a few feet from her heels. And when she lay down that night, he climbed onto her chest again, as before, like he belonged there, as if he'd done it 100 times already. Solace didn't leave. If anything, his presence became more of a fixture over time. He no longer sat by the door, gazed out the window, or lingered in thresholds. He was always with her, nestled between her feet during breakfast, curling around her ankles in the hallway, and each night settled silently onto her chest to rest. It felt natural. That was the strangest part. Marla's days began to blur together. Her sleep came more heavily now, and she rose later than before, at 10, or sometimes nearly noon, constantly sluggish and always thirsty, unwilling to move for hours after waking. Solace never stirred until she did, and when she shifted beneath his weight, he would look at her expectantly. Her limbs grew heavier as the week passed, and her appetite waned. Food lost its appeal, though she forced herself to chew dry toast and drink warm water. She stopped checking her mail. The manuscript she was editing for a woman in Montana sat unopened in her inbox. It no longer seemed urgent. Once, she caught herself staring at the wall for nearly 20 minutes without blinking. On the fifth morning, the sun hung low and bloated behind a scrim of pale clouds, its light drained of warmth. Marla opened the front door to find the street empty. There was no traffic or mail truck. Even the birds seemed to have gone silent. She walked to the edge of her porch, squinting toward the neighboring house across the street. Mrs. Denton usually watered her garden at this time, Her marigolds had spilled past the borders of their flower bed the prior spring, and she fussed over them with quiet devotion. But the yard was overgrown now. The hose lay curled and cracked, wind chimes hanging still in the stale air. Marla stepped off the porch. The sidewalk was warm beneath her bare feet. She wandered toward the corner store, just to check. 3 blocks down, she saw someone. A young man with blonde hair walked toward her on the opposite side of the road. He moved slowly and stiffly, like he hadn't slept. A tabby cat clung to his shoulder, its claws sunk in gently, head close to his ear. The man didn't speak or look at her. He didn't seem to notice her at all. Farther ahead, she saw a woman pushing a stroller. A sleek black cat padded along beside her, brushing against her calf in time with her steps. Behind them, an older man in a polo shirt shuffled down the sidewalk with a cat perched on his back. It sat between his shoulder blades like a bird of prey, unmoving, its tail twitching in rhythm with his stride. No one looked at each other. No one spoke. Marla stopped and turned around. Behind her, Solace stood, waiting on the porch. His yellow eyes narrowed. He leapt down and walked calmly to her feet, rubbing once against her ankle before stepping ahead of her, leading the way home. She followed without a word. Before long, the cats were everywhere. On rooftops, on fences, in windowsills that had always been too narrow to perch on. Marla saw them sunning on cars that never moved and sitting motionless in the middle of driveways, their heads turned toward doorways as if they were waiting to be let in. They didn't chase birds and grasshoppers, paw at moths, or even eat so far as she could tell. They simply were everywhere. Solace remained her shadow. He no longer strayed even a room away. If she turned suddenly, she would find him already watching. He rarely blinked and never purred. One night, she awoke to the sensation of Solace on her chest again. She tried to sit up and couldn't. The cat seemed heavier than ever. And this time, he no longer rested on her ribs, but pressed through them, sinking deeper. As he stood atop her, she became keenly aware of a pulling feeling. With each of her exhalations, Solace's chest appeared to expand. At first, she suspected their breathing had become synchronized. But something was wrong. Her limbs responded sluggishly, like she'd been drugged. She moved one finger, then two, and even that took considerable effort. Employing all the strength she could muster, her chest only rose slightly beneath the weight. It was then she realized that the cat was not simply breathing in air. He was siphoning hers, one breath at a time, and there was nothing she could do about it. When morning came, she had recovered somewhat, but barely remembered the night. Nonetheless, she didn't question the aching hollowness that clung to her limbs. She remembered what had happened, every terrifying moment. That afternoon, she tried calling her sister. The phone rang 4 times before a wall of static answered. She could hear someone on the other end, labored breathing, followed by a soft clicking sound like claws on plastic. Then, her sister's voice emerged through the noise, faint and strained, saying something Marla couldn't understand before the phone disconnected. She didn't call again. By the next day, the act of standing had been torturous. Marla tried to leave the house only once after the cats had fully arrived. It was early morning, and the sunlight hadn't yet bleached the sky into that thick, endless white. She stepped out onto the porch and descended the first 2 stairs before her knees buckled. She crumpled forward onto the grass, the blades sharp and hot beneath her palms. The sky tilted, the sidewalk shimmered. A low ringing began at the back of her skull and bloomed outward until she couldn't hear the birds, the breeze, or the cicadas. Everything folded inward, and she closed her eyes just for a moment. When she opened them again, she was back in bed. She didn't remember walking. She didn't remember rising, moving, or climbing the steps. And yet, there she was, in bed, with the sheets drawn to her chin. And there, lying across her chest, with one paw pressed flat against her throat, was Solace, his gaze fixed on something beyond her face. She reached for him with trembling hands, her fingers floating upward as if underwater. She brushed his side and felt warmth rise from him like coals. Marla tried to sit up, but couldn't. Her body still answered her, but in strange, delayed increments. She thought of moving and waited to feel it happen. A second passed, then 10. Then her arm would twitch, or her foot would slide an inch against the mattress, as if her nervous system had grown unresponsive. That night, she dreamed of bodies. On beds, on couches, on sun-bleached grass. Some curled in a fetal position on hardwood floors. Each had a cat on them, stretched across their ribs, their necks, their backs, watching, feeding. None of the bodies struggled. None breathed. But they didn't look afraid. Their faces were slack and faintly smiling. Their mouths parted slightly, as if forming words they would never say. She recognized some of them, people from the grocery store, the neighborhood, or memory. The young man with the tabby, the woman with the stroller, her sister. Marla woke with a start and nearly screamed, but even that proved impossible. Solace still lay across her chest, and he had grown heavier again. Worse yet, his fur no longer felt like fur. His body was warmer than it should have been, and beneath the thin skin of his flank, something unnatural pulsed. That's when she began to understand. The cat's presence itself was making her weak. She only felt well when he wasn't near, which was not often. And yet, even with this knowledge, the idea of a night without him seemed unbearable, even terrifying. He was draining her of life, day by day, one breath at a time, and she no longer had the strength to fight it. She waited for the heat to dip in the late afternoon before trying again. She would walk, she had decided. She didn't know where. It felt like something she had forgotten how to do, and that was reason enough. Solace watched her dress from the bed. He didn't move when she stood, and didn't follow her to the door. He remained exactly where he was, nestled into the hollow her body had left behind. Marla stepped outside and found the town silent. The sun filtered through a gauze of gray haze. A parked car up the street had moss growing on its tires. Marla passed the house next door. Its porch light was on, though it was still daylight. The windows were open, and beyond the screen, she could see someone reclining in an armchair, arms folded neatly in their lap. A white cat lay across their chest. Neither of them moved. She kept walking. At the corner, she paused beneath the warped stop sign and looked down the hill toward the park. The grass had turned yellow, and the trees drooped under the weight of the heat. She saw three people spread across the benches and lawn, each one still and slumped, their limbs arranged in unnatural ways. One had collapsed across the edge of the sandbox. A cat lay curled on each of them, one black, one orange, one gray, all of them as still as statues, and they were staring at her. She moved on. At the edge of town, Marla passed the community center, where its glass door hung open. Inside, the receptionist's head lolled against the back of her chair. A ginger tabby perched across her collarbones like a scarf. The post office door was locked. A plastic sign inaccurately proclaimed, "Back in 5." The market was dark, its shelves half-stocked and its register drawers ajar. Marla saw a man asleep at the butcher's counter, his forehead resting against the glass. A cat crouched behind his neck, nose against his ear. Marla didn't try to speak to anyone for fear of attracting more attention to herself. Legs shaking, she reached the park again and lowered herself to a bench beneath the oak tree at its center. She didn't remember bringing solace, and yet, there he was, waiting for her. He leapt into her lap, circled once, and settled across her thighs. She closed her eyes. And when she opened them again, she was home. The next day began like the others. She opened her eyes to dim light and silence. The fan above the bed had stopped spinning, and dust hung in the air like ash suspended in syrup. Her mouth was dry, and her breath came shallow, though she barely noticed. She didn't reach for her phone. She no longer needed clocks. Solace lay beside her, his body pressed against her side instead of across her chest, his head resting against the hollow of her throat. She could feel the faint pull of him, like a tide moving through her ribs with each breath she gave. She rose sometime after the sun passed its peak. Her movements were slow, but they no longer frightened her. She poured a glass of water, though she didn't drink it. She changed her clothes and brushed her hair. These small rituals felt abstract now, as if she were performing them on behalf of someone else, someone she had once been. At dusk, she drew the curtains closed and bolted the front door. The world outside no longer held meaning. The town, the trees, the sky, none of it mattered. What was real lived inside the house. What was true waited in her bedroom. She wasn't certain where these thoughts originated, but they arrived all the same, and she hadn't the strength to refute them. She returned to her bed without ceremony. Solace sat in the middle of the bed and faced her, tail wrapped around his paws, his body rigid in anticipation. She took a seat on the edge of the mattress and looked at him for a long time. There was no sorrow or final protest. The fear had gone days ago, replaced by something soft and warm and terrifying in its comfort. She lay down. He stepped forward slowly, no longer with the casual grace of a house cat, but with the gravity of something old and exacting. He climbed onto her chest with ease, each paw placed precisely between her ribs. His body was even heavier now, more than it had ever been. Her lungs compressed beneath the weight, and her heartbeat slowed. Solace lowered his head until their faces nearly touched, and Marla allowed her eyes to close. In the stillness of the moment, as she breathed weakly, she became dimly aware of a sensation like warmth being drawn outward. Wisps leaving her through parted lips, trailing into the space behind the cat's teeth, of something essential leaving her. She thought vaguely of a line from an old dream. When the breath forgets its body, the body forgets its name. She couldn't remember her name now, only Solace. And in that final moment, rather than fear, she felt something perilously close to love, even as she grew paler by the moment. One last time, she raised a hand to stroke the cat, and exhaled, her final breath consumed by her feline companion the instant it escaped her body. Satisfied at last, Solace nestled into Marla's chest and purred. The town remained quiet in the days that followed. Porch lights stayed on through the day, flickering dimly at dusk before fading with the sun. No doors opened, no windows shifted. Lawns turned brown in the heat, and weeds grew high along the sidewalks, curling around mailboxes and fences. A pair of crows perched on a telephone wire, cawing once before lifting off again. Nothing answered them. The breeze came rarely, and when it did, it carried no voices. It was the third day when someone came. A white delivery van rumbled down the main road, the first sound louder than the town had heard in weeks. The driver, a man in his 40s with a faded ball cap and a half-eaten gas station sandwich on the dash, slowed when he saw the emptiness. No one flagged him down. No one stood at the corners. He passed a bus stop with three empty plastic chairs and a bench where a woman sat unnaturally still, her chin tilted toward the sun. She didn't move as he passed. He didn't notice the small gray shape curled across her collarbone. He kept driving. At the third address on his route, he parked outside a sagging bungalow with dead hedges and a cracked front step. He knocked once, then again, and received no answer. He leaned in to peer through the front window, but the curtains were drawn, the glass coated in a film of dust. The door was unlocked. He turned the knob partway, testing it, and then reconsidered. "Creepy-ass town," he muttered. "Where is everyone?" He checked his clipboard, signed the package himself, and left it on the stoop. As he walked back to the van, he noticed something on the hood. A cat sat there, gray and unmoving, seemingly indifferent to his approach. It didn't seem the least bit curious. It stared knowingly at him with large, pale eyes, its body perfectly still. "Shoo," the man said. The cat didn't budge. For a moment, he reached for it, then thought better of it, surprised at the sheer heat radiating from its frame. He started the vehicle, and with that, the cat lazily took its leave, walked to a patch of shade beneath a tree beside the sidewalk, and sat. As he pulled away, he checked the rearview mirror. The cat remained in place, watching the van shrink into the distance. At the edge of town, he passed a small girl on a pink bicycle. She pedaled slowly, weaving slightly as she rode. A black and white cat followed closely at her side, matching her speed, brushing occasionally against her shoe. The man considered stopping to ask if she was okay, but she didn't look at him. She didn't look anywhere at all, other than straight ahead. As the van disappeared down the road, the girl turned the corner and vanished from view. Back in town, the cats began to move. Some leapt from windows, while others padded down driveways. Quietly, dozens of them descended from the rooftops, gutters, and trees, their eyes gleaming as they crossed the empty streets. They gathered at the edge of town as the sun fell, their bodies a shifting mosaic of fur and shadow. From the cracked pavement of the main road to the brittle grass in the park, they formed a loose, patient tide, their eyes reflecting what little light remained. At the center of the road sat Solace. When he rose, the rest followed. Silent, unhurried, and purposeful, they padded past the dead hedges and sagging porches, past skeletal mailboxes and rusting cars, until the road at last carried them beyond the last crooked fence post and into the open fields. By nightfall, the town was empty. And somewhere, miles away, in a neighborhood still filled with porch lights and the hum of conversation, a single gray cat appeared at the end of a driveway and sat perfectly still, waiting for someone to notice. That was Solace by Laurel Veitch, performed by yours truly, Malcolm Blackwood. Some guests leave paw prints on your heart. Others leave you a little less alive than before.
And by the time you realize which one you've let in, it's already curled up right where it wants to be. Our third tale begins in a place already weighed down by grief. But some tragedies don't end with the funeral. They echo, howl, and call you back long after the mourners have gone. This is The Howl and the Wail by Matt Martinek, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Grace, I'm so sorry about all this. I'm behind you, the community's behind you, and we'll do whatever you need us to do and help in any way we possibly can. You and John are not alone. Don't forget that, ever forget that. Dr. Corcoran's leathery face gleamed with slow-drying tears as he spoke these words of consolation to me. He fixed his spectacles back onto his nose as they slid from the wetness. He proceeded to inch closer for an embrace of some kind, but I turned quickly and moved back toward the house, my tired eyes focused upon the stony path before me. My little girl was dead, and the silent birds of mourning were already circling as the casket descended. Words and well wishes no longer meant a damn thing. The official prognosis was typhoid. Our neighbors, Mr. Robbins and old Lady Eleanor, who came down with it a little beforehand, but they pulled through, strangely enough, given their ages. There were other cases as well, but those were more than a few miles away. The first thought was the well water, but no one ever was really sure. My little Martha started having stomach pains on Sunday morning, and by Tuesday, things were already looking grim. It's truly remarkable how life can turn upside down at the drop of a hat. How do you go from a happy, running, jumping little girl to a stricken, bedridden corpse to be? What kind of God would allow for such a thing? No God of mine, I can tell you that. John and I struggled to find comfort as the days passed and Martha's condition worsened. Dr. Corcoran tried to alleviate the pain as much as he could, but it was clear that Martha was going through something that none of us could wrap our heads around. No amount of medicine seemed to help. My little girl was so brave. You could hear her moan from rooms away, but as soon as we would enter her bedchamber, the noise would disappear. She didn't want us to worry. She'd lie there drenched in sweat, her blonde hair now a stringy brown for all of the moisture, and try to stay as coherent as possible. For us, not for her. She was only 9, but she had a demeanor of a soldier, lying low upon the battlefield, but refusing to give in to the wounds. She was a magnificent child. The Sheepies, our 2 male sheepdogs, remained at Martha's bedside the entire time as she went through hell, a hell no person should ever have to endure. Their names were Benny and Bill, and we owed them ever since Martha was a baby. Black and white, beautiful creatures they were, and as furry as you could imagine. They were gifted to us by John's father, and right away they became the protectors of the child. It was truly a sight as Martha learned to walk by grabbing onto their haunches, balancing herself as she went. A household full of barking and laughter was the one thing we enjoyed best, and it's a shame it couldn't last. After Martha was pronounced deceased, and I, as well as my husband, fell to the floor in disbelief and anger, Dr. Corcoran and his assistant attempted to remove the body from the premises. As soon as they laid a finger upon my child, Benny bit into the doctor's hand with such force that it drew blood onto the floorboards. The dogs would not let her go, and neither would we. It's difficult to describe the terrifying haze of preparing for your child's funeral. I kept thinking about our last words to each other. Mama, I'm not going to die, am I? I could barely process the question. Oh, honey, you'll be just fine. You're prettier than the angels. They would be jealous. Have you ever heard of jealous angels? I guess sheer beauty amongst the angels wasn't an issue, as my child was scooped up by their wings nonetheless. John took the time to carve out a wooden cross for the interment until he could get a proper stone to use for a marker. The inscription was the worst thing I had ever read. Martha Winthrop, loving daughter, 1884 to 1893. A beginning and an end of a story that was criminally unfinished. I insisted on preparing her hair and her favorite white dress as she liked them done in a very particular way. I suppose, in some fashion, it was my final goodbye. I made myself believe that she was only sleeping because that's the only way that I could go through with it all. For a moment, I actually thought that I had seen her eye twitch. But I knew it was just wishful thinking, as if she would just jump into my arms like she was playing a child's joke. I finished with the flowers in her hair, kissed her goodnight, and handed her off to the very heavens themselves. What do you do after your life is shattered? I sat at the kitchen table and stared off into better times as I tried to block out the sheepies' whines and cries. John stood outside, smoked his pipe, and looked into the sky in a stupor as if somehow he would find an answer to all of this pain. It would make it even worse. John was due to return to work in less than 2 days to toil away with a railroad. He insisted on staying, as any husband would, but I knew it would be good for him to go and busy himself as the emotions took their time to blossom. And of course, we simply needed the money. Reluctantly, amongst the shedding of many tears, John walked away to deal with his own demons, as I dealt with mine. It was just me and the sheepies, and a whole lot of pain. The moments alone in the house were the ones of blackness and unrest. The events of the previous 2 weeks played out over and over again in my mind. The sickness, the fever, the hurt, all upon my daughter's face as she fought against the fates. I did not eat. I did not sleep. I sat there at the same kitchen table, in the same dirty nightgown, with my head in my hands. I struggled to put all these pieces together, to make them real, to make them exist. It didn't seem true at all, but instead some ridiculous nightmare that I knew I would wake up from someday. It would just take time and patience, after all. Nothing this bad could possibly befall a family who did exactly as God intended. We worked, we loved, and we prayed. What more could there possibly be? What did we do wrong? As I drowned in my sorrows and forsook the events that brought them, I eventually realized that I had not seen or heard from the sheepies since the very moment that John left for work. I gently got up from the table and proceeded from room to room looking for Benny and Bill. I'd been sitting for so long that I didn't feel my legs underneath me. I felt like I was floating above a floor that no longer seemed necessary. Each room produced nothing, but as I approached Martha's bedroom, I completely expected to find the dogs there, cuddled up where my sweet daughter used to sleep. But again, no sign of Benny or Bill. Eventually, I moved to the front door and cracked it open to meet the chill air of a Minnesota October. I called for the hounds, but they didn't answer. My eyes fell beyond, past the stony path, back to the tree line where Martha was. Maybe. Just maybe. I slowly made my way up the path, my heart beating a bit faster with every step I took. I never liked going up there. Too many forgotten memories. And I was not one to dwell on the past. After all, the past can kill you if you let it. But now the family plot held even more meaning than ever and contained the very vestiges of my happiness, Martha herself. I trudged up the slight grade into the tree line, paused for a moment and held my breath, and stepped directly into view of Martha's grave. And there they were, Benny and Bill, sleeping on the fresh, loose dirt which covered my daughter's earthly shell. "Oh, my, you hounds, there you are. Just come back to the house. I'll feed you both." I went to touch Bill on the head and was met with a severe growl and a clear view of his teeth. He snapped at me sharply, and I withdrew with a shout. I'd never seen either of the dogs act like that in all the time we'd owned them. I was taken aback for a moment, but quickly realized I should have expected this. Thick as thieves they were, Without Martha, Benny and Bill had no purpose. I knew that feeling well. I left them there, alone with their best friend. On my way back to the house, I stepped into the barn and grabbed John's .22 caliber rifle, which he had hidden in the loft for emergencies. I returned to the house, kicked off my shoes in the doorway, and floated, still weightless, into the back bedroom where I sat down on the side of the mattress and began to prepare. I knew it was selfish of me, but I just couldn't handle it. John would be absolutely destroyed and he would probably follow suit, but I just couldn't imagine going through life without Martha. She was my meaning, my reason for going on. So I decided to meet her on the other side. After a few minutes of contemplation, one lone tear dripped down my cheek. I cocked the hammer, I placed the butt end of the rifle onto the floor, grabbed the barrel, positioned it directly under my chin, and moved my foot near the trigger. I began to inhale and exhale quickly, my chest heaving in and out as I gained the bravery to make the necessary shot. And right at the moment of truth, with my toe upon the trigger, I heard the front door creak open, followed by footsteps. Not just any footsteps, but the quick, pitter-patter footsteps of a child. "Mama, what are you doing? Daddy said to never touch his gun. It's not a toy." Martha ran toward me as my mouth fell open and my eyes widened to let all of her beauty in. I placed the gun on the bed as Martha jumped into my lap, dressed in the same white gown I'd prepared her body in. I inhaled the sweet perfume of lavender from her flowing blonde hair and felt whole once again. It must have been a dream, after all. My daughter was alive and well. The doctor must have been wrong. I wept as I held onto my daughter and thanked the heavens for giving me life, giving my life back to me. "Why are you crying, Mommy? Everything's okay. I'm with you. Can we go pick daisies now like we used to? Please, Mama?" She tugged at me to go outside, and I gladly followed, giddy like a child myself. Martha got to the front door and stopped. "What's the matter, dear? Are you okay?" I turned Martha around by the ball of her shoulder, and I saw my daughter, face of fright, with tears streaming down her face. She was looking around as if she couldn't even see me. "Mama, I'm scared. Where are you? It's so dark. I don't like the dark. Benny, Bill, help me, Mommy. I'm dying." As she spoke her final word to me, the specter of my daughter fell apart bit by bit into a million grains of sand onto the floor. I grabbed for handfuls as the grains spilled about, but it all slipped through my fingers, as did my sanity. I knelt upon the sand-covered wood and fell away into the dark. I bolted upright at the sound of something peculiar. I was hazy and groggy, but those damn hounds wouldn't let up. I must have fallen asleep. The .22 was still there next to me on the bed, but it was no longer the dark of nighttime, but instead the blinding brightness of a bright new day. The barking seemed to get louder as I regained my bearings and remembered the plight of my poor child. She was in the dark. She needed her mother. And her mother I would remain until the end of time. I ran out of the bedroom as fast as I could, through the kitchen, and out the door, which was already ajar. With grains of sand still falling out from between my toes, I darted towards the barn where I snatched up one of our shovels and proceeded to sprint up the hill where my poor daughter would be waiting for me. As Martha's wooden cross came into view, I also spotted the hounds deep into the work at hand. They were already about a foot or so into the loose dirt, using their paws and teeth to remove as much as they could as they attempted to rescue their little friend. The dirt flew about like a black rain, and with shovel in hand and nothing to lose, I happily joined the storm. We dug and dug for what must have been hours. But strangely, in a situation like that, the passage of time was reduced to nothing but a meaningless construct, rendered meaningless by a grieving family's will. The sheepy's paws and mouths were bleeding badly at this point, but they did not slow, not even for a moment. My right heel was a wet crimson, with the bone shattered as I pounded my naked foot onto the step of the shovel. The sweat burned my eyes, and my muscles were tearing from the bone, but I noticed that my cries had turned into uncontrollable laughter. I was going to see my little girl again. Shovelful after shovelful, I inched closer. Finally, a few feet down, the tip of my shovel stopped upon the dull knock of a wooden coffin that encased my beautiful princess. I slowed down at this point, realizing that I had to get the dogs out of the hole we had created in order to remove the lid. With all the strength that I had, I hoisted Benny and Bill up and out onto the ground level. They snarled and bit at me and attempted to jump right back into the grave, but I swung at them with the shovel to keep them at bay. I dropped to my knees as I carefully removed the soil around the edges of the casket, some by shovel, some by hand, until I had enough room to work. I pried at the nailed lid at each corner, bending the metal, cracking the wood of the shovel handle. It would not let loose. I began to panic, and my laughter had now turned to sobbing. My daughter needed me. With one last desperate attempt, I jumped onto the handle with all the weight of my body, and the lid popped off the coffin. The hounds let out a howl, and I bellowed a wail as the birds flew from their branches. Neighbors were jolted awake, and God himself took notice from beyond the clouds he hid behind. My beautiful Martha lay there, in hideous form and grotesque fashion. Her mouth was frozen agape in a painful contortion, with her eyes held open wider than I'd ever witnessed in her natural life. Her hands rested upon her chest, with her fingertips covered in fresh blood and utterly bereft of fingernails. The bonnet was now crumpled at her side, exposing a nearly hairless scalp, marked with severe scarring and discoloration. Her soft blonde locks, mixed with wilted petals, were strewn about all over her body as feathers caught in a strong wind. We were too late. That was The Howl and the Wail by Matt Martinek, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Grief has a way of making the familiar unrecognizable, but sometimes it's not just the grief that's changed things.
And sometimes the thing calling you back isn't memory, it's the one that never left. If you've enjoyed tonight's journey into the shadows, remember, there's more waiting for you in our patrons area.
For just $7.99 a month, or less, with an annual plan, you'll unlock extended editions, bonus stories, and ad-free listening every week.
Join us at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com or SimplyScaryPodcast.com. Click Patrons at the top of the page and dive deeper into the dark.
And to those already supporting us, thank you. You keep the fire burning and the stories coming.
Tonight, we've ventured beneath the covers, into empty rooms, through haunted streets, and deep into the woods, only to find that the shadows waiting there weren't nearly as far away as we'd hoped.
Horror doesn't always live beyond the edge of a map. Sometimes it's waiting right where you stand. You just haven't stepped on the right floorboard yet.
If you're joining us on YouTube, don't forget to subscribe and turn on notifications so you won't miss the next time we open the door.
And tell us in the comments which of tonight's tales stayed with you the most.
Our thanks to authors Margot Klein, Laurel Veitch, Matt Martinek, and Mark Lynch for sharing their nightmares with us.
Until next time, friends, keep your doors locked, your lights low, and your ears open.
Sleep well, listeners.
If you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschen. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?